From the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, this is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. Hope Benito Smith's first book, The Way a Door Closes, won several awards, including the Coretta Scott King John Steptoe New Talent Award and the Judy Lopez Award from the Women's National Book Association. The sequel, Keeping the Night Watch, won the Coretta Scott King Honor Award. She wrote and illustrated her most recent book, Mother Poems, and works with music, art, and photography in addition to teaching word shops to aspiring writers of all ages. She is a writer in residence at the Thurber House this summer. Welcome to Writer's Talk.
Thank you.
Well, you've worn many hats throughout your creative career. You've been a storyteller, a teacher, a photographer, an artist, and a singer. How do you bring all of these dynamic artistic backgrounds into your writing?
Well, all of them have to do with words. And I love words, and so that's how they all get incorporated together. I started out doing storytelling at a bookstore in Los Angeles, Children's Book World, and from there I kind of branched out. My writing career, as far as being published, didn't come until years later. Mm-hmm. And I was taking classes and attending writing workshops and sent my work off to a couple of houses, and that's how it began.
So were you a paid storyteller, or you were just telling it in the bookstore and eventually they paid you to keep you there?
What they paid me from the beginning, and it all started because I was a nanny and I had taken my charge to a storytelling at a bookstore, and the woman there was telling a story about seals that were being killed for their pelts, and she had made up a song about it, and I was appalled. And I went to my local bookstore and got on my soapbox and complained about how this shouldn't be so, and they asked me if I'd like to come and do a storytelling. They had Leo and Diane Dillon coming, and that was my first official storytelling gig.
Okay. So no other stories about seals being killed for their pelts
no.
in your books?
No,
okay.
Never.
Right. Right. That rules out the Bambi fathers?
Yes,
kind of
death. All gone, all
okay,
gone.
No, okay.
Just good, clean, wholesome fun,
happy,
and kids, yes,
okay,
getting to
enjoyable.
Laugh and sing and not having to worry about animals that are suffering
killed
and dying.
For the pets.
Yes, exactly.
We'll wait for junior high for that.
Exactly, okay. Exactly.
Do you find it difficult to balance your creative outlets, or do they work towards a more complete work of art? How does that work for you?
I really find that they do work towards a more complete. I have a lot of interests, and I find ways to incorporate all the things that I enjoy doing into whatever I'm working on so that I don't feel like I'm missing out on anything. When I go to schools and speak, storytelling is often a very big part of what I do. When writers are asked to come into schools or to go to events at a library or a bookstore, 9 times out of 10, your audience is going to be very young. Mm-hmm. My book is for a much older audience. So if I had nothing else, I'd be stuck kind of reading my work, hoping that a few parents were listening, and I would lose the child audience right away. But because I can throw in a song, or I can tell a story and get them to participate with me and just talk a little bit about how I've published a book and give them just an overall view in a very simplistic manner so that they can understand, I get to keep everyone. Okay. And it gets to be an enjoyable experience for them all.
How did that work out for Keeping the Night Watch? Tell me how all of this came together for the sequel to your first book. Did you think of the presentation of it in terms of a lot of songs? How did that get written?
No. The first book, the thing that runs through it is there's a grandmother, and a lot of lines refer to things like, she's a rock that's planted by the water, and I shall not be moved, which were Negro spirituals, and my grandmother always sang hymns and things around the house, and so that was kind of a thread that ran through the first book, and that thread continued on to the second.
Okay. Your books are written and illustrated for children and young adults. How do you approach your work differently when you are writing for a younger audience than, say, if you're writing for an older audience?
You know, I let the characters kind of dictate that. I don't really think in terms of writing for a particular age group. I tell the stories that the characters bring to me. Okay. And after that, we figure out where, publishers actually figure out where that story should be in terms of age. And a lot of times it's kind of inaccurate, only because there are some very precocious children who can read things that are much older and vice versa. And there's some children who are older that just can't handle some of the subject matters that are brought up. So my books are geared for 8 to 12, and I really kind of think of them as being for 10 up through 99. Okay. Because adults relate to them as well as children do.
Okay. What kind of universal issues then are you dealing with that you think that people can identify with when you're writing?
In the first two books, we were dealing with broken home, fathers who are not a part of the family mm-hmm. for a short period of time or a long period of time, older children taking on responsibilities that their parent once had, feeling like they need to help their mother out or take care of their siblings and kind of letting go of some of their youth to make that happen. Mm-hmm. And at the end, I hopefully gave a little bit of hope in The Father Returns at the end of my first book. Mm-hmm. And then the second book deals with him trying to regain the trust and respect of his family. And I, of course, when I was writing it, had no idea how it was all going to come out. But the one thing that I did know, however the situation resolved itself, their family was forever changed. They could be a family again, but it would never be exactly like it was.
Okay. Now, did your childhood in Akron, Ohio, your mm-hmm. connection to Ohio, right, affect the characters and situations that appear in your novels?
Only in that my grandmother lived in Ohio until she passed away, and the grandmother in my book is based on my grandmother. Mm-hmm. And so my connection to Ohio ran through her in my books.
Okay. But nobody else in your family plays a part in that? It's not a autobiography?
It is not, no. Yeah. I tell students when I go into the classroom, if you've ever seen the movie The Sixth Sense, the little boy says, I see dead people. Mm-hmm. And I don't see dead people, but I hear characters. And characters come and they tell me their story. And my job is just to be the person who writes it down. I mm-hmm. document it.
Mm-hmm. I think on your website you phrase it as they come to you and demand that their stories be told.
Yes. Whether I want to tell it, there are a couple waiting right over here okay. who are waiting for their stories to be told.
Are you going to pan to the side to show the other? Because there is just a group of people over here. What other artists or writers have influenced your work? Who do you think of when you're writing?
Maybe. I did a lot of oratorical readings when I was younger. And of course, very first and foremost would be James Weldon Johnson, Nikki Giovanni, Edna St. Vincent Millay, a lot of poets. And first and foremost would probably be Maya Angelou, who I went to see perform at Redlands University years ago. And she came out on the stage and she started reciting a poem by County Cullen. And I remember I couldn't even close my mouth. And I said, I want to do what she's doing. I want to make that connection with my audience.
Okay. Do you feel that connection when you're reading too? Have you been able to do that?
I do. I really do. My goal this year is to do, even if it's just in a 99-seat theater, an evening of poetry with Hope Benita Smith. And that's my beginning of kind of following in Maya's mm-hmm. footsteps.
I like how you've got a very specific number. 99,
well,
at least 99.
Yes, yes.
If it's a 100-seat theater, that's better.
That's right.
But no 98-seat theaters.
That's right.
Nobody's standing in the aisle.
A 99-seat theater, yes.
Everybody has goals.
That's right.
What other genres in particular shape the kind of work that you do? Do you feel, we've already talked about the presence of song and things like that. Is there dance? Do you think of it as a performance when you do it?
I do think of it as a performance. I have absolutely no rhythm at all. So dance is not a part of what I do.
But there's a rhythm to the words.
Definitely. I tell kids it's not just poetry that has a rhythm. I think all writing has a rhythm. Mm-hmm. And that's why when I speak to them and I say, if you want to be a writer, you need to be a reader. Because you learn to hear that rhythm as you're reading. I mean, that's the thing I think that spurs us on to reading, turning the page, that music that we hear through the words on the page.
And so when you're hearing the rhythm on the page and the characters speaking to you through this, what particular elements of a character's struggle do you think sort of commands you to put it on paper? There's something really compelling about these characters in the side of the room that are getting you mm-hmm. to put them on paper. What is that? Is it the story? Is it what makes you, say, get out of bed to write something down about a character?
It is their story. And I think all of us, as human beings, we all have compelling stories. I think we don't realize it sometimes. I say to students, you think your lives are so boring. I said, but you have to think about that Thanksgiving dinner where Aunt Lulu showed up and she ate the pumpkin pie before dessert, so there was nothing to have for dessert, or, you know, Uncle Louie who comes down in his boxer shorts when he's not supposed to. I mean, there are things that happen in your family that are story worthy mm-hmm. that we don't think about. And all of that came about because I believe that the oral tradition is still very important as far as storytelling, et cetera, is concerned. And I let students know there are people who will decide that you shouldn't read certain things in a book. They will either, you know, take the books out of the library or take out passages thinking that they're protecting you from something. But no one can take away your voice and the story that you have to tell about your family experience. And it's all great. You hear old people saying, now, when I was young, we had to walk 5 miles in the snow uphill.
Both ways.
Exactly. And we want to say, oh, stop, please. We can't take it anymore. But those are the stories. I believe that a lot of us know our family story that we're living right now. We might know our grandparents' story. And a few of us, if we're really lucky, know our great-grandparents' story. But after that, very few of us know anything beyond that. Mm-hmm. And that's sad that those family histories, those oral stories, die when that person dies, because that's all part of your heritage and your legacy. And it's sad that we don't listen to older people anymore, or even take the time to have them come over and let that be what the day is about, mm-hmm. learning about our past.
Where do you go for your oral stories? Is it just family events, or are there other places that you've run into people that tell really great oral stories?
Everywhere. Mm-hmm. Coffee shops, bookstores, just out on the street. I'm kind of a conversationalist. Mm-hmm. I like to talk. I used to get in trouble in school for talking too much. But if we are open, people really want to share their stories with us. And so I listen to everything. I was in a bookstore one day and I heard three teenage girls, and one of them said, you know, Sarah's mom really likes me, but if she only knew. And that was it. And I remember that line and I kind of file it away in a category, mm-hmm. somewhere it might show up in a story, but mm-hmm. here's this teenage girl who thinks she's snowed a mom, mm-hmm. and probably unbeknownst to her, mom probably knows what's going on. Mm-hmm.
The Eddie Haskell
exactly.
phenomenon.
Exactly, yes.
So do you feel responsible for making your characters or a character like that a voice heard? Is that what compels you to be a writer? You said that whether you wanted to do it or not, those voices come out. Now, is that just a sense of responsibility, a sense, and if so, to whom? To you? These characters are figments, right?
I feel a responsibility as a writer in a number of ways, but as far as their stories and them coming to me and asking me to tell it, I think that if I tried to create it myself, it wouldn't ring true. I think that's the beauty of listening to them and writing their truth. Because if I tried to incorporate what I felt or what I thought, I think there would be just something that didn't quite work. I can see that in a lot of writing. I was in a critique group and a friend had given me her manuscript to read. And I read the manuscript and I came to her and I said, oh, you know, this part here doesn't quite, and this part here doesn't quite. And every part that I brought up, she said, but that really happened to me. And I said, but is this your story? If it's your story, then you need to take that character, because all those things that are in there that happened to her, they don't work with what happened to you. If you want to tell your story, then you need a whole other book. But you're kind of inflicting, you know, yourself onto your character, trying to merge the two together. It doesn't gel. It doesn't work. So my responsibility, I just feel like I can get the best story possible by being true to the character and their story.
What are your favorite kinds of characters to write about? Do you have a particular, do you like working with kids and having them tell the story? Do you adults, women, mothers, what are the favorite?
I like them all. My first and second book, the main character is a young man. And I say to the kids, now I have never, and still am not, I've never been a boy in my life. Mm-hmm. But when I started working on the book, I was writing it, the character was a young girl. But her relationship with the dad in the story is wonderful. He's a good man. And I was a little bit jealous that there was a female character that had a better father relationship than I did. And so when I would start creating the poems, they always came out he. And I just had to give it over to that. But I think that there was something in me that couldn't have a female character have a dad that was, you know, that wonderful. It's like she was bragging.
That's really interesting, because it gets you into sort of this situation as an author where you don't like the rivalry of your own character. Do you have other emotions that you've recognized, like besides, oh, I dislike this character or something like that? What else, you know, how else does that get processed for you?
Sometimes it comes in aversion, you know, you avoid it. That's why they're still over there,
right?
Because some of the things that they want me to say, I'm not ready to be on their side. Mm-hmm. And of course, I'm discovering I don't always have to be on their side.
Yes,
I think that's kind of, that makes for even more interesting writing, to be telling the story of a character and not be in love with or have a great love for the character that's speaking. So I like the challenge of that possibility.
Do you feel the same tension when you're reading? I mean, do you feel when you're reading other writers to pick up, say, experiences from them, or not really tricks, but lessons from other writers, how often do you go through and you go, you know, I really don't like this character, but the writing is compelling? Because I think that's a pretty common feeling for young students. They're like, oh, I don't like, young readers, they're like, oh, I don't like the character, they don't relate to the character, and it'll sort of stop them.
Mm.
But is there some way that you've been able to get past that? Occasionally when I don't like a character, I might not necessarily finish the book. I've tried to read a lot of great books that great books I have to confess that I just couldn't care about.
I don't think that I've ever had a character that I didn't like in the way that I would say, oh, I don't want to finish this book. I kind of embrace that dislike because to me, especially if it's a character that's not supposed to be likable, then that to me means the author has done his job and has created that character in a way that gets the point across. Mm-hmm. So that to me is good writing. And stories that don't have the endings that you want or that aren't going the way that you want them to go, I love that because I think sometimes we get kind of pat in things. In my first book, no one wanted the father to come home at the end of the story.
Because it was a happy ending or because it was...
Chicago Tribune said, we love the poems, etc. The only thing that weakens the story is the father's return. And I thought, that's interesting. But I go back to that whole thing about my responsibility as the author. And it wasn't even just my responsibility. That father came to me and said, this is not who I am. Mm-hmm. I'm not a dad that would stay away from my children.
Okay. He
was introduced in the beginning of the book to be a certain kind of person. And then you're going to have this total metamorphosis into the man who leaves his family and never comes back.
Right.
It didn't work for him, which means it didn't work for me. This is I've Got a Mama from Mother Poems. I've got a mama who combs and plaits my hair with gentle soothing rhythms, fingers dancing everywhere. I've got a mama who wraps me in her arms like I'm some kind of present, says I'm her lucky charm. I've got a mama who loves me through and through, and can't nobody love me like my mama do. Thank you.
Now, as a teacher, you host word shops, and
yes,
not workshops, but word shops for children and adults, and you did some for the Thurber House while you were a writer in residence. Tell me what a word shop is and how you help to find students to find their voice during one.
They were workshops, but we're dealing with words.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought word shop was most appropriate to what we were doing. And my goal in the word shops is to introduce young and old to language. I have a love of words, and I can't believe I'll say this on public radio. I absolutely love country music because I believe it's great, first of all. I can't tell you the number of people who won't let me listen to it in their cars, but I love country music because it tells a story. A lot of country music tells a story, and I like that aspect of it. And so in my word shops, I want to introduce them to words. I want them to learn to love words and how powerful they are and how they work, how they can make you laugh, how you could set them up in certain ways to create just about anything that you want. You can create all kinds of emotions. You can create laughter and joy and sadness. You can just be silly and nonsensical. So I think if I can get them to learn to love words, it opens up the door to writing and reading and oral communication.
But you don't start off with a country music song at your word shop.
I don't, but you know, now that you've said that, I might have to have a few.
Yeah, sure. Start off with, you know, Johnny Cash shot a man in Reno just to watch him die,
no,
and then go from bring it upbeat.
Country music has come a long way, and it has grown drastically. Actually, I'm working on a novel right now, and country music will be something that will be discussed in there. And
really?
And I will bring a little bit of myself and the pain that I feel from being a lover of country music and being the person that I am. So.
Okay.
It doesn't really go together. That's what they tell me.
Yeah. Do you think your teaching has made you a better writer when you're working with
students? I do. I actually do. And I do every assignment that I give to my students. And a number of the assignments that I've given to them have turned up in the three books that I have out right now. Okay. And the reason why I write when they write is because I don't want to be the teacher who gives an assignment and then sits and waits and, say, oh, it's easy. This is how you do it. It can be done. Just do it. I do it with them because I want them to know that the more you practice, the more you work, this will be what you will write like eventually.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What other creative projects are you thinking about pursuing in the future? Are you going to do some, you've got another book in the
yes.
in the works, or are you?
I have a novel in the works right now. Okay. And there's a possibility I will be doing a companion book to my new mother poems. Might have a companion father poems. And I illustrated that one. So we found this real new thing in art. So I'm hoping to expand that a bit. I did the pieces for the book.
Now, what do you mean you found a new thing in art? What's the
I
new
was
thing?
I'm not
oh,
an art.
Oh,
I was
you
not
found
an
a
artist.
Not as you found a new technique. You're breaking
yes.
it out of the way. It's
yes.
a new thing for you to
yes.
be an artist.
Okay. Yes. I am a writer. I was a writer.
Okay.
Now I'm a writer. And an artist, illustrator.
How did that come about? What was happening?
My editor suggested that I try my hand at illustration. I make all my cards and stationery.
I'm glad that that's the story behind it, because I was worried. He said he read my writing. The editor read it and said, maybe you could be an illustrator.
Yeah, try this instead. Maybe yeah. this is for you.
Maybe a country music singer.
Well, I have an immense amount of respect for the illustrators. It's it is not for the faint of heart. It will never be my first choice because I think there are 500 million people who can do it better than I can. And I leave that realm to them. But I did enjoy the process. And when my editor suggested it, I wanted to say no. And my feeling is that you can never say no if fear is the only reason why you are saying no.
What media?
I use torn paper.
Okay.
So torn like paper collage. Yes.
Okay. Why?
Because I'm very anal about things. I like circles to be round. I like squares to be square. And tearing the paper allowed for some margin of error. It wasn't perfect.
But that doesn't sound like anal. That sounds like the opposite of being, there's a messiness, and you're never going to get a circle that's completely round tearing paper.
That's why I did it.
Okay.
That's why I did it, I needed to step out of that, because it's hard to get even when you're working really hard and you have a little compass thing, it's hard to get a circle that's perfectly round, but if it's not, I will know it, and it will bother me. And so can you imagine the number of circles that would be tossed to the floor until we got to the one that was just right? So this was my way of saying, it's okay for it not to be perfect. The lines don't have to be perfect.
Okay. So it's the opposite.
Yes.
You're rejecting
out of,
that
yes.
part. Yeah, okay.
Yes. And I did really well.
Okay.
I was very proud of myself.
What genre haven't you written that you'd like to try? Is there a nonfiction book coming up? A cookbook? What else is...
Oh, well, I would love to do a cookbook, but even more so, I would really just like to write something humorous. I'd like to write funny. I don't think I do funny.
Okay.
I think
what kind
I can
of funny,
be
like
funny.
A joke book or
no, just a humorous, yeah, humorous story.
Okay.
Everything I write is very heavy. I mean, I cry through it. People read it and they cry through it. With my mother poems book, I really thought it would be a great idea to have a little packet of Kleenex tissues when you buy the book that it should come with.
That'd be a big sales aid, I imagine.
Yes.
Right? You know, here's the book and here's the tissues. That'll move them right off the shelves.
Well, people want to be moved. It's, and it depends on how you're moving them.
But
and
maybe,
we can also laugh so hard we cry. So.
Right, yeah. Maybe that's the next step. That's the next brilliant marketing tool.
I want no tears. I really just want good, funny book. That's what I want. It's not going to be this novel that I'm working on now. That's not going to do it.
Okay. What's your secret vice of an author or a writer? What would it surprise people that you read? Besides listening to country music, what would it surprise?
Graphic novels.
Graphic novels. You're the second person that said that. There's a secret shame among writers for graphic novels, I think, because of the movement away from the text.
And yes.
But you're doing your own illustrations. Why are graphic novels?
I did one book.
But it was more than one
so
page.
Far. That's true, it was. Well, because there was a stigma to graphic novels. And also, even when I go into the graphic novel store in L.A., there's a certain type of person that you see in there. And I'm not, no disparaging remarks about anyone, but it's not me. And I found that I love them. And not, you know, I read Jughead and Archie when I was little. Those are not graphic novels to me. Those are comic books.
Right.
But now I've discovered graphic novels. I'm doing Why the Last Man and Ex Machina and, oh my goodness. I mean, mm-hmm. nobody who knows me would believe, Fables, one of my favorites, and mm-hmm. nobody would believe
that. Did you
that
go see Watchmen, the movie based on the graphic
I
novel?
I didn't see Watchmen. I saw 300.
Okay.
Watchmen got a lot of hype, and people kind of, so I wasn't anxious.
What did you think of 300? I mean, I'm just curious.
That was wouldn't be a movie that Hope would go and see. Mm. But I thought it was amazing.
There's all these jokes to be made out of that. I would hope you'd try that and things like that, and I won't do that because, you know, I'm not
thank
that
you.
Kind of person. I'm above that. I would hope I'd be above that. But anyway, I want to thank you very much, Hope Anita Smith,
my pleasure
for coming to talk to us today. And again, your books are available at Amazon.com and a number of other places. Your first book is The Way a Door Closes,
yes.
without the little sound there
yes.
that I made because I couldn't think of the name of it. And Keeping the Night Watch. And your third book, what's it?
Mother Poems.
Mother Poems, right.
Yes.
And they're all out right now.
They are. They are all available now.
All right. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you very much for having me.